This week on Making Contact.
Nosotros no vamos a poder cambiar.
We aren't going to change the system with papers, with multicolored banners. We have to take another path, the path of the revolutionary struggle.
As many Latin American countries are moving away from long-standing dictatorships, they still face the challenges of poverty. Structural adjustments imposed by the International Monetary Fund and increased privatization of resources characterize the region's economic policies. In response, peace and social justice groups challenge these policies by implementing the concepts of worker solidarity, sovereignty, and civic participation. On this edition, we'll take a look at workers' movements in Argentina and Bolivia, and how residents of Montreal are using the citizen-based model of democracy from Porto Alegre, Brazil. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Argentina's economy hit rock bottom in 2001 after a default on snowballing external debt and stringent economic policies. The crisis left millions unemployed, and workers became the engine of internationally renowned social movements. The unemployed picketers, or picateros, strategically demonstrated by blocking roads in demand of solutions to the crisis. Their direct action proved successful. The government granted them work plan subsidies. However, unemployment in Argentina is still high at 20%, and thousands of workers have stopped waiting for the government to solve unemployment problems. Making Contact's Pauline Bartolone reports from Argentina.
While many unemployed workers take to the streets, some 12,000 turn to abandoned factories. The mere 150 pesos a month in government subsidies to the unemployed is just not enough, says one marching piquetera.
En vez de planes trabajar, ¿por qué no reactivamos las fábricas y nos dan trabajo?
In the face of these government subsidies, why don't they open up the factories and give us work, or put them in the hands of the workers? We are the ones who know how to make the factories function, so why don't they put us to work? But the politicians have decided not to do so. Neither President Kirchner nor the ones before him had this idea. They're all the same.
When private investors abandoned businesses, workers took over management themselves, operating as non-hierarchical collectives. Now 160 workplaces in Argentina operate without bosses, such as the Brookman textile factory in Buenos Aires. Delia from Brookman remembers when the workers took control.
Cuando bajamos del tercer piso, bajamos a la oficina.
When we came down from the third floor, all of the employees had already left with all of their things. So we asked the owner, Jacobo, what was going to happen. How much was he going to give us? And he told us that no money was left, that he had only 2 pesos to give each person. So we said that we were not going to accept this. So he said, well, okay, if you are all able to manage the factory on your own, here are the keys. I'm leaving. So he left.
The remaining 60 workers decided to assume control of the factory. They were left with a building to take care of, no pay, and a 7,000 peso debt from the owners. Delia is a mother, like most of the other Brookman workers. Before the crisis, the women supported their families and had little social engagement. But when hit with the crisis of unemployment on December 18, 2001, they reached out to the larger community for help.
Porque no teníamos un centavo, ni para viajar ni para comer.
We didn't have 1 cent, not to travel or to eat, because it had been months that the old management had been giving us 5 pesos per week. Really, this was just paying us to come and work. So what did we do? We put a box in the sidewalk and the neighbors started to help us with food. And with another box, we asked the people that went by for money. At the end of the day, some of us had money to travel home and others had money to eat in the factory. So that's how it was for a month.
Así los quedamos durante un mes.
The workers prepared backstocked clothing for sale, made contact with old clients, and within months, they were out of debt and earning a better wage than with the private owners. Each factory has a unique story, but many face the same obstacles. Most are grappling with the government over property rights and equipment. Chila Verde is a book publishing collective of 9 workers in Buenos Aires. Since they assumed control of their factory, they have survived eviction attempts and financial hardship. For Ernesto Gonzalez, the decision to assume control of Chila Verde was about community responsibility and survival.
Nos vimos obligados ante una situación en la que las persianas de la fábrica se nos cerraba y quedábamos en la calle.
We found ourselves in the situation where the doors of the factories had been closed in our faces. We were out in the streets facing the certain possibility of a frightening misery. So finding ourselves in that position, we had to decide in that moment whether to break the law and occupy the factory. From my point of view, there was a choice that had to be made between what is legitimate and what is legal. And we think that working is legitimate. If the machines are able to function and there is a need in the community to consume our production, then it would be wrong to close it. There are contradictions here between the right to property and the right to work. And obviously, we are on the side of the right to work because it is what permits us to live. If we don't work, we die.
Si no trabajamos, morimos.
Chila Verde is part of a new movement within occupied factories that are seeking ways in which the public can participate. In December 2003, a cultural center was inaugurated on the second floor of the building. At the ceremony, Chila Verde worker Candido says that factories like his would not be able to succeed without help from neighbors, other factories, and the popular assemblies.
Lo único que quiero decir, a ver si me hacen coro ahí. Ocupar, resistir y producir.
In the audience was Sebastián Maísa from IMPA, a metal container factory just a few blocks away. A sculptor, Maísa helped create art studios and a gallery on the fifth floor of his factory. The integration of a cultural space not only helps gain legal status for worker-owned factories, but facilitates a systemic change that workers like Maísa are seeking.
Y la punta de lanza de la dominación económica.
The spearhead of economic domination is cultural penetration. So society that is dominated culturally is also dominated economically. Only when you lose your identity, which is your culture, it's easy to dominate you and take advantage of you. So when someone is in struggle, they see that the reality is a consequence of a system that transcends them. So in this struggle, with national politics, you have to work with cultural politics.
Workers in occupied textile plants, ceramics factories, even hotels, all experience personal transformation. The Brookman women, now activists, say they heard the words Trotsky and class struggle for the first time during the factory occupation. The consensus decision-making model, or direct democracy, as Gonzalez from Chila Verde calls it, is a process in which all workers are empowered to vote and speak without a representative. However, says Gonzalez, the factories still need to compete in a capitalist framework.
Hay que entender que estamos en el marco siempre, ¿no? Esto que hacemos aquí que parece, no sé, una sociedad.
Although this may appear to be a utopian society here inside the factory, we still have to take the products that we produce and go out into the marketplace and compete like everyone else. So while democracy exists from the doors of the factory inward, outside these doors, it's a jungle.
Las puertas del taller para afuera es la selva.
Despite competition and government obstacles, workers have gained support from the larger community. Brookman textile workers survived tear gas, rubber bullets, and thousands of policemen during 3 forced evictions with the help of their supporters. Celia Martinez from Brookman says that they serve as a model for others to follow.
And all of the struggle that we have had, it was without letting our hands down. To the government, it looked like something that 60 women workers shouldn't do, and they want us to think that it's something that can't be done. But we say it is, and that's why we did it. It is just and necessary to reclaim our right to work, to bring a wage to our homes for dignity. It's also to give some hope to other workers who continue to struggle. They can open factories. They can put factories in production governed by workers without owners, without the intervention of the government. We have shown that it is possible. Se puede.
The Brookman factory was expropriated from the state in December 2003, and the workers have returned to their factory without owners. For Making Contact, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
In the 16th century, the Spanish Empire enslaved Bolivia's indigenous population and forced them to spend short and miserable lives in tomb-like mines. Silver and gold were shipped back to Europe by the boatload, serving to decorate Gothic cathedrals and pay off Italian financiers. More than 400 years later, a tiny elite of European descent still holds a monopoly on political power and the country's resources. Correspondent Reed Lindsay reports on how the poor and indigenous majority is fighting this inequality, and in the process, redefining democracy in Bolivia.
Leonilda Zorita radiates defiance. Zorita is the first generation of her family to grow up outside of servitude, and she speaks with pride of her dirt-floored home and small farm in the Chapare region of central Bolivia. She grows coca leaves there, in open violation of a U.S.-sponsored prohibition against the centuries-old crop. The coca leaf is used to make cocaine, but it is also chewed by ordinary indigenous people like Zorita, who consider it to be sacred. As a cocolero or coca farmer, Zorita has dodged rubber bullets and tear gas in clashes with Bolivian soldiers. She has been thrown in jail for a month, and she has marched in protest for 30 days across jungle and up mountains. In the process, the 35-year-old mother of two, along with 35,000 other cocolero families, have helped drive a rising tide of civic activism among Bolivia's two main indigenous peoples, the Quechua and Aymara.
Our coca already has a presence in parliament. They chew coca there. There are women with skirts and braids. Before, the parliament wasn't like that. It was white ties and the women wore clogs. But now, change is here. Now, campesinos like us can get power.
In Bolivia's 2002 presidential election, coca farmer Evo Morales shocked the region when he lost by less than 2 percentage points to mining magnate Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada. Morales' movement towards Socialism Party, supported by cocoleros like Zorita, became the second most powerful force in the parliament. Never before had a political party led by Bolivia's indigenous poor come so close to the presidency. But few were prepared for the firestorm of protests unleashed in October 2003, when tens of thousands of indigenous people blocked the highway running into La Paz through a sprawling slum called El Alto. Miners, farmers, students, and members of neighborhood associations in El Alto cut off the capital from the rest of the country, demanding the government repeal a highly unpopular deal to export natural gas to the United States through neighboring Chile. The government sent in troops to break up the road blockades, killing dozens of unarmed protesters in the process. The protests only increased in size, however, and on October 17th, Sánchez de Lozada fled for exile in Florida. Teodoro Calle, a 31-year-old street vendor, was shot in the left leg during the protests. 2 weeks later, leaning on crutches outside a church community center in El Alto, Calle said he was worried. He had spent a week in the hospital, he said, and his family hadn't eaten for several days. But Calle said he didn't regret participating in the protests.
La gente consciente, ya no somos antes sí, tal vez estábamos ahí.
The people are aware. Before, perhaps, we agreed to everything, but not anymore. People now know what's going on. For example, in the provinces, we still cook with wood, but the government wants to sell the gas abroad at the price of a dead chicken. That's why we're fighting. Every neighbor, every Bolivian, that's why.
Like most people in El Alto, Calle immigrated at a young age from the surrounding countryside in search of a better life. He ended up selling clothes on the street to support his wife and four children. He said he would like a steady job with a living wage, but that there were none in El Alto or in La Paz.
We want the gas to be industrialized here, in Bolivia. That's what we want because every country that sells its raw materials is poor. The country that industrializes its own raw materials is going to have more money, more jobs. That's what every Bolivian wants. Around 80% of Bolivians want that.
After Sánchez de Lozada's ouster, his vice president Carlos Mesa took power and immediately gave in to the main demands of the indigenous protesters. Mesa promised to hold a referendum on the gas export deal, to revise the laws regulating the oil and gas industries, and to convoke a constituent assembly, which would seek the creation of a new constitution through active citizen participation. The so-called gas war has been widely recognized as the most significant indigenous-led revolt in Bolivia since at least 1899. But the seeds of rebellion had been planted just 3 years before. In early 2000, factory workers joined students, cocoleros, and other farmers in massive demonstrations in Cochabamba, dubbed the Water War. The protesters opposed the privatization of the state-owned water company, which had imposed rate hikes. Government troops fired tear gas and rubber bullets, but were unable to quell the demonstrations. Authorities were eventually pressured into rescinding their contract with the company, which was a subsidiary of Bechtel, a multinational construction firm based in San Francisco.
Ese modelo se toma para el tema gas también.
Luis Sánchez is a priest who helped lead protests in both the water war and the gas war.
La guerra del agua del 2000.
The idea was the same in the gas war. The water war of 2000 is the first strong experience, which on the one hand perforated the economic model because it rejected a multinational company that had made its investment, and we repealed a privatization and made it once again a social good and a public company with social control.
Y una empresa pública con control social.
Sánchez runs a community center in a poor neighborhood of southern Cochabamba.
Y por otro lado, la experiencia aquella generó una...
On the other hand, that experience generated a recuperation of the voice of many people, of their dignity, of the feeling that they own something and have a right to participate in a democracy that excludes them. Because we have a democracy that excludes, it doesn't permit referendums, it doesn't permit participation beyond voting every 5 years. It's representative. The Constitution says the people don't deliberate, nor do they govern except through their representatives. That is, the people don't have a constitutional right to deliberate, to discuss issues, to make proposals, to participate in the government except through their representatives. That experience allowed people to make opinions and decide.
Fuera la que opinara y decidiera.
Many indigenous Bolivians, like Aymara leader Felipe Quispe, say that the system of representative democracy is rigged. They fear that even if an indigenous leader won the presidency, the entrenched white elite, backed by the United States, would sabotage any attempt at real reform.
We aren't going to change the system with good faith, with papers, with multicolored banners. We have to take another path, the path of the revolutionary struggle, which our ancestors have taken, like Tupac Amaru and Tupac Katari.
Quispe is referring to two legendary indigenous leaders who staged revolts against the Spanish Empire in the 16th and 18th centuries before they were captured and executed.
In this moment, we've proposed having two arms, two ways, a democratic arm that complies with the laws and another arm, more revolutionary, that brings out mobilizations and hits the government any way it can. The indigenous movement has stopped the first arm and has worked with the second arm in these last days.
Bolivia's indigenous-based social movements are waiting for Mesa to comply with his promise to hold a referendum on the gas export deal with the United States and to convoke a constituent assembly. But after several months of relative calm, their patience is wearing thin. In April, 20,000 people filled the streets of La Paz in the first major demonstration since the revolt in October 2003. Quechua and Aymara leaders warn the president must either allow the indigenous majority a say in deciding the nation's affairs or face protests similar to those that toppled his predecessor. For Making Contact, this is Reed Lindsay in La Paz, Bolivia.
We'll have more about participatory democracy in Latin America in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Brazil has the 10th largest gross domestic product in the world. But despite its enormous wealth, Brazil is still plagued by social and economic inequality. Porto Alegre, a large city on the southern coast of Brazil, is no exception. The poorest half of the city's inhabitants make less than 15% of income. But during the past 15 years, the people of Porto Alegre have developed a more equitable and citizen-based system to distribute money. Inspired by the model in Porto Alegre, a group of citizens in Montreal, Canada, are seeking ways to implement participatory economics in their city. Correspondent Sujata Day reports.
It's spring in the Portuguese Park in the neighborhood of Plateau Montréal in Montreal, Canada. Posters for concerts, art shows, and demonstrations cover the posts of the cobblestone park. This park was erected by some of the Portuguese immigrants who used to live in this neighborhood. Originally, this was a neighborhood of immigrants who worked in the textile industry. Now, it is hyper branché, trendy. Even so, the neighborhood has a long history of activism. Dimitri Rosopoulos is the publisher of Black Rose Books, one of the first publishers of Noam Chomsky. Rosopoulos is also a resident of Plateau Montréal.
The plateau has always been, historically, going back to the 1940s, a kind of hotbed for the left.
Rosopoulos and a handful of activists want to import a new kind of democracy to their neighborhood. It's called participatory democracy. So they're looking to Porto Alegre, Brazil. There, each year, over 50,000 people participate in drawing up the budget of the city. First, citizens meet to decide the priorities of their neighborhoods. Then they send citizen delegates to the regional and municipal levels. What makes this process different than from other democracies is that citizens, not their representatives, make the decisions. Anne Latendresse is professor of geography at l'Université du Québec à Montréal. She is researching the participatory budget of Porto Alegre. She says over the past 15 years, they have been successful in involving low-income people. They simplify the process so even people who can't read can be involved. She says the benefits are many.
Most of the local governments, they take decisions which respond to the interest of the dominant groups or the elite. They take decision to build an industrial park or to develop this road or this network of roads, and they reverse the priorities of the city. The city level has started to answer to the needs of poor people before the needs of the elite. It's an improvement of the standard of living of poor people. Clearly, it's shown with statistics and so on. The second point is the governance of the city. There is much less corruption. Almost no corruption. In fact, I did not hear any examples of corruption in Porto Alegre. And here, the World Bank is promoting the participatory budget. People were thinking why the World Bank is promoting such experience. They said it's clear. That's the answer to corruption. So you do not have corruption because inhabitants have a direct control over the economic resources of the city. So it's not only elected, it's the inhabitants themselves. So it's an exercise of good governance, transparency, good management, improvement of the standards of living of people in their neighborhoods, and moreover, a very fantastic exercise of learning citizenship.
Elected officials in Porto Alegre and the World Bank have supported the process, but not without reservations. One concern is that if citizens make the budget, there will be no role for elected officials. Another potential pitfall is that this gives power to a new clique of citizens who are not elected. As well, young people who are often employed tend not to participate. They just don't have the huge amount of time necessary for the process. Luc Grabois is part of the Working Group on Participatory Democracy in Montreal. He went to Porto Alegre to see if this model would work in Montreal. He says the process is not perfect, but in the end it is much better than if there were just elected officials involved. In particular, he's liked how it brought out different decisions than those urban planners might have made.
They enter in the process to defend the project for their own community. And in the participation, they learn about the needs of other peoples, are poorer than them. So they stop to defend their project and they begin to help others. So we can see solidarity. It creates a space to talk about the community and how to live together. It's like a school of citizenship.
Two neighborhoods, the Plateau Montréal and Notre-Dame-de-Grâce, have implemented some elements of participatory democracy. In Notre-Dame-de-Grâce, people participate in the neighborhood budget. In the Plateau Montréal, they have created committees to involve citizens in making decisions. Neighborhood politics may not carry weight in most cities in North America, but in Montreal, it does. Montreal is one of the only cities where most of the decisions are decentralized at the neighborhood level. So something that starts in the neighborhood could impact the whole city. At the neighborhood level, citizens can now participate in neighborhood council meetings, an important element of participatory democracy. Roussopoulos says this in turn has already changed Montreal city policy.
In February of last year, as the war clouds were generating around the Middle East, specifically Iraq, our borough council, through the initiative of a local organization, adopted a very good resolution against the war in Iraq. Now, that happened at the borough council level, but it didn't stop there. The mayor of the borough council, because our councils are run by borough mayors, like in Paris, our mayor, Helen Fotopoulos, then took this resolution and took it to City Hall. And to my great pleasure, City Council also adopted an anti-war resolution.
Luc Rabouin studied how the city government could go further with a participatory budget. He says that there are things that could easily work here, but not everything. For example, in Porto Alegre, residents spent over 20 hours a week in meetings, something unfeasible for Montrealers' busy lives. Also in Porto Alegre, they are dealing with basic needs like water and basic roads, whereas Montrealers' concerns are different.
I think the only thing that we have to import here is the spirit of Porto Alegre and this idea of the participatory budget. The mechanic, it's another thing for me.
This is Sujatha Day for Making Contact in Montreal.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Anna Hilardini, Carol Maddox, Eric Klein, Brian Edwards Teekert, and Christopher Martinez. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of the program, Working Democracy, Participatory Movements in Latin America, program number 2004, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. Or visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Pauline Bartolone, associate producer, Susanna Hines, associate manager, Rochelle McKee, office manager, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, and David Barsamian, national advisor. And I'm your host and director of production and training, Amy Pomerleau.